Welcome to the Ephesiology Podcast, in our series, Christ in Your Context, exploring why Jesus is good news where you are. We have Michael, our resident Ephesiologist. I'm Andrew Johnson in Houston, Texas, and we are joined by Kathy Richards-Bhatia. Kathy Bhatia serves as the Regional Director for the Middle East and North Africa at She Is Safe, a Christian nonprofit ministry working internationally to keep women and girls safe and free from slavery. Kathy and her husband, Amit, share a love of Indian food, international travel, theological education, and the beauty of the Pacific Northwest. Kathy, thank you so much for being with us today on the Ephesiology Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we are super excited that you're here, Kathy. And I always, when I see you, always remember how we first met back in, can we talk about that? I guess we can.
Yeah, I think so.
Totally legit.
Yeah.
In Egypt several years ago. And it was so fun having you come up to me and introducing yourself and saying that you and Amit were married. And that was exciting because Kathy's husband was a grad assistant of mine while we were at Trinity. Not only that, perhaps more importantly, he would demolish me at tennis.
Yes.
Still remember that. And I think it's still a traumatic experience.
Yes, yes, it is. He's good.
Okay, so Kathy, aside from your husband's just mad tennis skills and putting Michael in his place, what are some things that we can know about you that's maybe that you're comfortable sharing on a podcast that some of your friends know that are beyond you, like really good food, traveling, learning, things like that?
Indian food, right? Indian and okay. Middle Eastern food, I will say, I'll add, because I am a... is it the fourth generation now? Yes, it is the fourth generation pastoral type. From my great-grandfather to my grandfather and my father, we're all ministers of the gospel, and I have the privilege of being a board-certified chaplain. And so all of that goes to my history. My parents were workers in the Middle East, and I was born in Baghdad, raised in Lebanon. So I have a deep love and appreciation for the region, and in particular the Lebanese people. They shaped who I am. So grew up during a lot of the Lebanese Civil War, and so I'm a war child. Lots of odd background pieces to me.
Okay, so for you then, what's your comfort food? Like what do you eat and say this is comfort?
Food. Well, food is not my most important thing, although I do.
It's not. You led me into it, and now I'm like really interested.
Okay, so it would have to be Lebanese manaish, which is a bread with za'atar spices. That's one that comes alongside to this breakfast. So manish with hard-boiled eggs and clear, dark tea with lots of sugar. That is the ultimate comfort food right there.
That's great.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
That is fantastic. I can, like, even though I haven't had all of the things you have talked about, I've had some of them. And it's like, ooh, that is wonderful.
Yeah,
that is good. Wonderful. Now, Kathy, forgive me. You got me excited. I do love the food and from all over. So I love to talk food, but that is not why we have had you join us on this podcast. So for this series, we have obviously the idea that Jesus is good news. As Christians, our whole lives rest on this one true fact that Jesus is good news. But what is also true is that Jesus is good news in certain ways to certain people, and he is good news in other ways to other people, kind of depending on your culture or where you are. And so we wanted to bring you on to learn from you a little bit about your current context, like the place where you are? Why is Jesus good news there? And then how are you seeing Jesus as good news in the work that you do globally? So if you don't mind, you said you love all things Pacific Northwest. So where is your locale?
Yeah, we're living currently in Salem, Oregon. Moved here about 5 years ago. And I mean, it's stunningly beautiful. The people are fantastic. We love our church. We feel like it's just a really sweet season. My main goal actually in life at this time, from a broader than, I mean, different than work or all the other things, is to lure my adult children to move here near me.
There we
go. They're not spread out across the rest of the U.S. So, you know, that would make my life actually perfectly complete. But in the meantime, we're just enjoying it. It's just so beautiful.
That's great. Well, as we're getting started here, Kathy, with this series and our conversation, I'd love for you just to share a little bit about your family history. I know your parents have recently passed away, but the way in which you have eulogized them is just amazing. I mean, I get goosebumps just thinking about it now. Yeah. Because it's such a beautiful legacy that you have inherited and passing on. So is that okay? Can you take a couple minutes and just share about your parents and who they were and how they shaped you? And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, what an honor to do that. Might cry because, you know, I miss them, but won't sob, I promise that. My parents, honestly, they were pioneers in that very clear pioneering spirit. They were called to the ministry in their young couples class when my dad was finishing up seminary in Atlanta, Georgia. And they were called to go to Iraq as a young family. They had, my brother and sister were young, but I mean, 2 and 3. And out of that class, so to kind of even tie it into how is God good in the places where you are, in that one young couple Sunday school class from that one church, in that season, 10 people, 5 couples were sent overseas and served lifelong ministries overseas, serving people around the world.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So my parents were the only Southern Presbyterians in the little group that they joined in Iraq, and they served there for a number of years. Through coups, through regime changes, through lots of difficulties, and they were finally expelled with the rest of the foreigners in 1969, and that's when we went to Beirut, where I then grew up most of my life in Beirut. My parents were introverted. They're not flashy people. They were quiet ministers of grace. Highly intellectual, each of them. My mom earned her doctorate at age 55 or something like that. My dad was a D-min, you know, Reverend Doctor. So we used to address mail to them as Reverend Doctor and Doctor. But they were involved in peacemaking essentially the entirety of their time in Lebanon. And then on, as they came back to the States, we had to leave in 1982 during the Israeli incursion into southern Lebanon at that time and escape by boat to Cyprus. I mean, it was a whole thing. It's a whole dramatic story. But they cared deeply about peace, about bringing peace in their personal lives, in their family lives, in their ministry lives, in the region. And it really, it set a standard of how do we engage this world. You know, is it, they were gentle. My dad was one of the most gentle people I've ever met. He would, one of my friends tell stories about going up to checkpoints in Lebanon and the, you know, the guys with their guns, and they get real kind of can be a little aggressive. And my dad would just sit there perfectly calm. No, you know, just no reactivity at all to the whole situation going on around him, and would just proceed through. And so he had this way of engaging people. They were people of peace. My dad, they, for years, even at my dad's funeral, there were people from some of the multi-religious groups that they would gather together to speak peace and learn how to move forward in peace relations in their community. So it was just a lifelong commitment to that. So education, peace, the church, all of those things. Sorry, I haven't done a very eloquent job, but
Well, you know what? It's beautiful because I see that in you. I see your parents in you. And that's really cool.
Yeah.
What a heritage. I think that's, and maybe it's because I'm getting old now that you start thinking about heritage and so on. Yeah. But yeah, it's neat to see that legacy continue.
It's incredible. And your mom getting a doctorate at 55. That's,
yeah,
it's just amazing. Like,
yeah. She was an extraordinary woman. They both died in their 90s. And my mom, I mean, she had, I don't want to say better, but really better relationships with all of her grandkids than any of the parents did. they both continued to reach out to them and to be present in their lives, and just beautiful. Commitment to people, I guess, is the bottom line there. So. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us then, how do you see their lives and in your life, just like we were talking about? How has that shaped you and helped you to do some of the things that you're doing today?
Well, of course, they set out a legacy for all of us in the family of serving people, serving God, having a bigger perspective than all of the wars and nonsense that happens in this world. We went back to Lebanon after the start of the civil war, and we lived there for 5 years during it. And that decision, I think about them as parents, people who were making a decision that they didn't have to make. They didn't have to return. And they did. And it's part of that legacy of being present, which I think points directly to Christ's whole being present in and with people in their suffering, in their need. And so that, I think, it's shaped my perspective on how do we live in this world. We don't live with the spirit of fear. We live with wisdom and also stepping into those places where God has called us, and that the ministry of presence is possibly the most important thing that we can weigh, that we can show who Christ is, regardless of where we live. So.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, just hearing you say that and knowing the places where you work, that says something. Tell us a little bit about how are you seeing Christ in those places?
Well, if it's all right, I'd like to kind of describe some of the work that we do and some of the people groups and the types of people that we are working with.
Perfect.
Is Safe Works exclusively in our programs with women and girls. We are quite focused in that, and we are working to prevent, rescue, and restore women and girls who are either at extreme risk or who have experienced slavery. So that's kind of the overall picture. We work in a number of countries around the world. All of them are in the 1040 window. I don't know if that's that's probably old language, but the places where there are the fewest number of Christians, and that is by design and very deliberately.
It's fair that we could say North Africa, the Middle East, South Asia,
right?
Asia.
So that band around between the 10 and the 40.
Between the 1040 window. Yes.
Yeah. Right. So we're a small organization, but we are a organization that works in partnership with local ministries. So I work remotely from the U.S. I travel a few times a year to our local partners. In the last few years, that has been problematic with the war and other unrest, with COVID, other things. But praise God for the internet, because we really have been able to move forward despite the issues of being actually present on the ground. So that's it's been a challenge. We work with trafficking. We're an anti-trafficking organization. And in the Middle East, where I work, I manage our partnerships there in the Middle East and North Africa. The kinds of trafficking that we are working to impact are forced child marriage, child sex trafficking, temporary brides, labor trafficking, and forced prostitution. All of these are the top ways in which trafficking occurs in the region broadly. Most of our programs are focused, that are working with the teen girls, are focused on preventing child marriage or delaying child marriage. And we have a number of ways that we do that. But there's a lot of talk about trafficking. It's kind of a hot topic,
right,
in our world. You know, it's very popular. It's very even defining what counts as trafficking and what is just egregious abuse or other things. I mean, I wouldn't say just, but what is, I mean, there's some definitions around that. And so we work hard as an organization to be working in the places with the people who are most vulnerable to those kinds of trafficking specifically. And so we work with broadly outcast groups, which somebody said, nobody knows what that means, right? So what is an outcast group? A group that generally in a society is rejected by everyone. They don't have papers, you know, legal papers to be present, or they are so poor, impoverished, that they actually don't have access to sufficient financial means to even feed themselves more than one. You know, they would live at the poverty level, one meal a day or less. So outcast groups, refugees, which is, they are extremely vulnerable to trafficking, and I can talk more about that at some, at a different time. But refugees across the region, it depends on which statistic you look at, but there are currently, I think, 2.8 refugees in the region, actual, that have had to leave their country. And from a number of people of groups, so the Syrian refugees, the Sudanese refugees, the Yemeni refugees, the Iraqi refugees, just internal to the region, this is a big group, and we are working with 2.8 refugees. Yes, and if you look at the displaced people, it goes up to like 17 million or something. I mean, there's just people internally displaced all over the place, right? So anytime you have a war or something that causes a large group of people to move, or a small group, the girls in particular, the women and girls, become significantly more vulnerable to traffickers. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's another group. And then the unreached people. So we are working in the region with unreached, unengaged. That's Joshua Project language, but unreached, unengaged people groups who have so few believers. So we're really working with the very edges of society, and that's exactly where we want to be. So kind of gives you a picture.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So with that picture, you know, obviously dealing with trafficking, human trafficking, people being forced into that through force, fraud, or coercion.
Right.
You know, that in itself is a good work. Full stop. Attacking that is wonderful. So my question for you, again, we can speak in generalities for just 1040 window areas. How are you all seeing, or how are you all bringing Christ to these as, so that he is being seen as good news, that he's being seen as wonderful and not the white man's religion or things like that?
Oh, yeah. Well, primarily, I mean, like 99.9% through our partners, our local partners, right? So we work through the most stunningly holy, godly, equipped, creative, amazing people on the planet, I believe. And they have way, I mean, they are local people. They speak the local language. They have a heart for these marginalized girls and women. And our role at She Is Safe is to equip them with either programs or activities or prayer or support in such a broad way that they can then impact these groups in their local communities. So, for example, yesterday we were talking to one of the leaders of a little center that is in South Lebanon. So this is an area that has been under Israeli bombing, yeah, under war for a number of months in the last several months. Right. And so this center serves outcast peoples in the region, little children and then teenage girls. Prior to the war, they had in their afternoon program for girls, they had about 15 girls that came regularly every day in a kind of a tutoring program. And integral to that was a Bible study, was an exposure to scripture. And they learned games, they learned financial management, they did health and hygiene, all of these things. Well, war came, many of those girls, their families were forcibly relocated to other places. So they were down to 6 of the original. And this is how God works. I mean, we've been praying for this little place and these particular people groups who are extremely closed to any outsider. It doesn't matter, Christian, you know, whatever. Religious isn't really the issue. It's societal, and the disdain that society shows these groups has created and is integral to why they're outcast people. She was praying. She went down one road that she hadn't been down before, right? She's just in the neighborhood. She needed to get some cakes for the school or something. And so she went into a shop she hadn't been in before. And as she went to this place, she looked around and she noticed a lot of street children who were selling little chiclets or little pieces of, you know, Kleenex. And she's like, well, who are these? I don't know these these children. And so she started asking questions, and she discovered, I believe, that God took her by the hand to this new camp. And in this camp, she started speaking with the parents, and she started noticing the girls, and she invited the families to come to the center. And I mean, in a remarkably short period of time, few weeks, there are now 18 new teenage girls at the center coming every day at a great cost to their families, right? So these girls had been either working in the fields, which is a slave labor type situation. They were at enormous risk of other kinds of trafficking, may have already been trafficked in other at other times. And now they're coming to this center, which to me is a miracle of God. So how is God working? God is taking people who are willing and able to look around and see a new little store and to notice the little children and to ask the questions and to go into places that are all of us would consider to be unsafe. I mean, you know, new, yeah. I mean, you know, and just engage and look at the fruit of that. And they know that this is a Christian center. They know, the families know this, and they're allowing it. Now that is a miracle of God.
So. Yeah. Wow. You know, there's, I mean, you're talking about this, and I keep thinking that there is an underlying worldview here, isn't there? A view of women, especially, that yes. is animating all of this behavior that's happening yes. that you're describing. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Right. There is someone who describes this so well, and I'm going to try to do it, and I won't do nearly the kind of job that particular sociologist or psych, I don't know what his profession is, but he does this so well. But he talks about the oppressed, the layers of oppression for this region, for women and girls. But it actually works anywhere women and girls are oppressed, are seen as second class citizens, are not seen or heard. You know, there's the physical oppression. Could be the clothes that they wear, or could be the ways that they are hidden, hidden in the house, hidden in just generally in society. There's the emotional oppression of being seen, yes, as second class citizens, as not having as their voices not having any worth. The psychological oppression, there is a lot of just generally because they are dismissed. I don't want to overstate this, but there is a sense that their feelings and their personhood is not as important or not as valued. So there's these layers of oppression that lead the woman to have some beliefs about herself that are diametrically opposed to how God sees the female person, right? Mm-hmm. Women and girls across the region have very few legal rights, if any. In divorce, they cannot keep children. The children will stay with the father. They do not have rights regarding abuse or property inheritance generally. So there's just a number of ways in which women are have life than men do. And then you add on top of that the desperation of people who are impoverished, who have no alternate ways of supporting their family than selling their girls. Mm. You have the incredible savvy world of traffickers who lure families into one of the most egregious forms of trafficking currently and happening, the online sexual exploitation of children, OSEC, which is a huge, it's just a huge, terrible form of trafficking. We had a girl in one of our programs who took a picture and sent it to someone. I don't know whether it was a trafficker or not, but it was discovered by the community. And it was not explicit, but in that context, if you normally are covered and you take off your covering and have a picture of your hair, it can be, you know, it's shameful. Mm-hmm. If there's a shoulder or some other, you know, thing that in our society would never be considered, outrageous, it can lead to a whole spectrum of community shame. Well, this was discovered. She was devastated and she ended up committing suicide because she was so ashamed.
That's horrible.
So this is one consequence. In the Philippines, there was a big study by International Justice Mission that came out a few months ago. They found that in the Philippines, something like 500,000 children had been exploited online. And the mechanism up for this was again, somebody luring them to say, "Hey, I'll give you some money if you, you know, have these, you know, show these pictures or do these things." And the egregious part, I mean, it's besides the act itself, which is overwhelmingly disgusting and sad. It's the parents in particular, often, who are selling this because they don't have other forms of income. Yeah. And there's not an understanding that this is trafficking, right? So there's just this whole, there's so many different ways this comes up, and it's getting more easier for traffickers to do this. Wow. So where do you find God in that? How do you engage the peace of Christ, the love of Christ, the joy of Christ, right? How does that happen, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
it comes to mind for me, the more you kept talking and kept sharing, just the passage in Mark 5, where you have Jairus coming and asking for Jesus to heal his daughter. So already we have Jesus making his way to heal a young girl.
Yep.
His care, his concern, his focus on her, his value of her. And en route to that is the woman who then touches his garment, who has been an outcast, who is a woman who is looked down upon. Mm-hmm. And Jesus heals her, not directly because he said, "Oh, daughter, I now heal you," but because she has that faith and she touches. I mean, this story is, the more you keep talking about the context, I just keep seeing Jesus' great love and care, his seeing them as his daughters, that he has this love. I mean, this is what's coming to mind, right? Of how Christ is just so beautiful, specifically in this context that you're ministering.
Exactly. Yes. And so we see this over and over again. When a girl who is so vulnerable, who is at such great risk, who is in fact being abused or trafficked or, you know, sold for whatever reason, when she has a safe place where she can have even a few hours at a time, where she can be a girl, and hear that she is indeed a beloved daughter of the Most High God, of that she has value, that she has dignity, that she has worth. That is completely true. I mean, it changes everything, right? And so over and over and over again, you hear, I have the privilege of supporting and walking with our partners as they are doing this work with the girls and the women. And the rapidity of the life change, right? Of the understanding that, oh, I have value. I have dignity. I have worth. I can learn to do any number of things. I can learn to crochet. I can learn to draw. I can learn to write. Many of the Syrian refugees, I mean, they never went to school. And so because it was not available. So how do you support that process? It's been stunning to just watch that and to be a part of that process in some small way. Mm-hmm. One of our programs in particular works with widows. And widows in Africa, and in the MENA region, they are a set apart group. And depending on who it is in both the Christian and the Islamic community, the widow is, once her husband dies, she becomes one of these outcast people. Mm-hmm. It was horrifying to me to really hear some of these stories recently and to understand that, like, even in the church, if they had been part of a Bible study, they are no longer welcome because now they're a widow. And so we've started working, and they have no means of gaining an income because they are a widow. And if they were working before, maybe they aren't, able to work anymore. So their options are extremely limited. They're very vulnerable to forced prostitution because that's one of the only ways they can make an income. So some of these women were already Christians when they became widows. Their faith is like, okay, God, where are you? And so we get to see what happens when a believer in Christ comes alongside this new outcast and reminds her that, in fact, God sees her and strengthens that faith so her faith would not fail, right? So, I mean, there's just all these different ways this emerges, and it's honestly, it's the best job. It's the worst job because you see the worst things, and it's the best job because you see God. I see God on a daily basis. I hear stories. I'm, doing miracles. So,
Wow.
Kathy,
wow. Amazing.
Thank you for continuing to speak peace to whoever you get to interact with. Again, to echo the previous, you are your parents' child, right? You are bringing that peace where God is sending you, and you are bringing peace to the leaders who are pursuing others in Christ's name through this organization. Mm-hmm. If anybody was like amped and mm-hmm. excited and mm-hmm. really wants to get involved with mm-hmm. She Is Safe, how would they do that?
Yeah. So this is, we're a small organization. We can't handle interns. We can't handle some of those things. But so honestly, there's a couple of ways. One way is to understand where trafficking is happening in your local community mm-hmm. and come alongside some of the people who are working to work with those who have been trafficked or who are at risk of trafficking in your own community. Get to know it and step into it. Yeah.
And I think that's important, Kathy, because, where we are in North America, we don't realize that it's prevalent here. We're blinded to it. We don't see it. But mm-hmm. in fact, at least it used to be, I know as we were engaging in this issue in the Chicago area, that there are more people trafficked in the United States than in many parts of the world.
Well, that is one statistic that is that is given.
That statistic does exist.
It does. I don't believe kind of. It's actually, I mean, there is trafficking that happens here. Absolutely. 100%. And often it's, you know, it's all in the same ways that it happens in other places. The prevalence in other parts of the world is much higher. However, in the States, the main difference is that we have laws. We have robust laws. We have law enforcement. We have lots of programs in place to combat trafficking. The places where we work, they don't. It's almost non-existent. So that's one of the main differences. However, you are right. It happens in your community. So understanding what's happening locally and then globally, becoming educated about this. Of course, we are at a place where we are ready to expand in the region. Actually, we've got some local partners who are already engaged in other ways in almost every other country, and so we could expand. And there are lots of other trafficking organizations, you know, coming alongside financially. Prayer, getting on our prayer letters. Lots of ways to do that. Andrew brought up some of the media that's been out about trafficking. Some of it is really helpful because what it does is it raises awareness that this is a problem. I would like to say about it that we have found that the most effective prevention of trafficking is long-term involvement in a community where you care for people over the long haul and you engage the whole family system in understanding how to change their perspective of women and girls, mm-hmm. how to gain income from other sources than selling their women and girls. So long-term prevention is actually much more effective than kind of the more flashy rescue situations. Mm-hmm. Now, there are rescue organizations who do a good job of that. One of the issues is what do you do after you have rescued someone? Are they more at risk? Because in fact, that is one of the statistical realities that once a woman has been rescued from a brothel or some other place, unless there's a very clear path forward for her, she becomes even more at risk of being re-trafficked. So just something to keep in mind. They do raise our heart, but
Agreed. Well, I was just thinking too, and maybe, I don't know if this is worth even mentioning, but there's something about the consumption of this as well, right? That has to be addressed.
Amen. Yes. So churches addressing the issues of pornography and sex slavery and sexual abuse and all of those things. It should be a conversation that's had with every adult in a congregation. What is, how are we pure in this way, right? Mm. How do we stay clean? The consumption of sexual exploitation in the places where it is the most prevalent, Thailand, Philippines, some of these places, India has brothel cities that are over 30,000 people, right? The consumption of that, there is some local consumption of it, but often it is sex tourism, right? Mm-hmm. Which is just, when I was actually thinking, I'm about to do some travel in the spring, and the first time this thought actually occurred to me, I'm going to pray as I go, that God would divert anyone who is on this plane who is planning to partake in sex tourism, because I don't know who they are, but it's trillions and trillions of dollars go into this. So,
It's disgusting. So I'm going to end with plugging your website. I am going to start by saying I am a part of an organization called the Freedom Church Alliance. If one goes to freedomchurchalliance.org, we have something. Shoot, that's funny. It used to be called the Go Box, but we changed the name of it. But you can go on our website, and it helps address, it helps inform in a non-flashy way, so that you can be educated about this. I have heard the analogy of when you hear something about anti-trafficking organizations working against it, you see trafficking and you're like, I want to stop it.
Yep.
It is like looking into a river and you are seeing people who are floating by and they are in distress. There are some organizations that are gonna jump in upstream to say, why are people floating in the river? We need to stop them from floating in the river. There are other people who are going to jump in to actually save the people out of the river. And then there are other people who are going to care for those who have come out of the river. Right. They're standing against trafficking is going to involve all three aspects of stopping demand and the aftercare, and then the, you know, again, and I'm talking about healthy versions of people who want to step out, not this bravado, let's rescue them, aren't we awesome?
Absolutely.
Yes. I mean, in a healthy way. Dealing with trafficking has a place. And if you are listening and you say, I want to get involved, there are actually needs for people to stay involved in all three areas. So you can go to freedomchurchalliance.org. However, Kathy, we have you on, and I would love for people to go to sheisfree.org. Did I say that correctly? Nope. She is safe.
She is safe.
She is safe. I'm the one who said Freedom Church Alliance. That's my bad. Sheisafe.org. Please go there. Please learn and also see what can you do to get involved. Is there anything else I can plug for you, Kathy, and the work that you all are doing?
That's it. Prevention, rescue, and restoration. We got to have all three. Or it's, you know, so yes, I agree with you entirely.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kathy, so much for your time, your wisdom, and your heart. We appreciate you. And we also appreciate you, the listeners, who've decided to join us today on this series. If you're interested in finding out more about the Ephesiology podcast, please jump on your streamer and check out our back catalog. We would love to encourage you with what's there. Also, we'd love to point you to masterclasses.ephesiology.com. You can go and see and join Kathy in this joyous theological education and go and see, okay, what is God calling you to? So for Michael, Kathy, and myself, thank you for doing Theology in Community with us today on the Ephesiology Podcast.